Risky Business. Risky Business. Risky Business.
Hiya, this is Risky Business and I'm Patrick Gray. This week's podcast is brought to you by Microsoft and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting at discounted rates. Thanks, Vigabyte. On this week's show, we'll be hearing from Brian Sarton of Verizon Business Security Solutions. He'll be discussing that company's 2009 data breach study. These guys have a pretty big forensics unit and their reports are very interesting. This study is to the InfoSec industry what black box reports are to the aviation industry. A post-mortem examination of what went wrong. It's very cool stuff. So you can also go to risky.biz to find a link to that report. We'll also be checking in with Stuart Strathdy, Microsoft Australia's Strategic Security Advisor. That's this week's sponsor interview. He'll be chatting about Microsoft's own security intelligence report. And let me tell you, there's some very genuinely surprising results to come out of that one. Before we get into this week's news segment, don't forget to go to our new website, risky.biz, and sign up for an account for your chance to win an EPC, which has been provided to us by Kaspersky Labs. We've also got some RFID reader writers and some sweet little toolkits courtesy of Microsoft. Now, it's illegal to offer a game of chance in Australia for these sorts of things, so go and sign up and we'll award the prizes to the people with the best usernames as judged by my mate's three-year-old kid. So there you go. It's now a game of skill and hopefully compliant with Australian gaming regulations. Fantastic. It's onto the news right now, and this week, Paul Craig joins us to discuss the week's news. And Paul, mate, SCADA, apparently Chinese hackers have, you know, infiltrated the power grid, and the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And I've got this story in front of me written, I'd suspect, by Rob Lemos. It was published on securityfocus.com, which basically says, yeah, look, we've all known for a long time that the power networks and stuff are quite vulnerable, so this ain't news.
No, this isn't news, but the sky is falling. I think maybe one piece at a time, but I mean, essentially this article was saying that the power networks and the critical infrastructure that our sort of world depends on is often really sort of insecure, antiquated, and when it was built, wasn't really built for security. You know, the people that are implementing these critical infrastructure, they don't really care too much about someone hacking the thing. They just don't want it to stop giving juice. I guess with the growth of the internet and how things are more accessible these days, now we're finding all this old SCADA equipment and critical infrastructure equipment is now accessible on the internet, so everyone can talk to it and allow vulnerabilities.
Yeah, like, I mean, no one air gaps this stuff, which I find quite hilarious, you know. I've heard stories of power plants in the United States where there's actually still space on the desks. The desks are quite big. So they were supposed to have their SCADA system and then their LAN systems that could bounce out onto the internet. They were going to use different computers. And there's still just these big blank spaces on those desks because the computers never turned up. So people have saved money by doing that, and they're still running all of their SCADA controllers on old pieces of shit like NT4 boxes.
If it still works, why fix it?
Yeah, well, that's it. Well,
why change it?
Let's say that after the sky has well and truly fallen in. Hooray. Now, this next story I find kind of interesting because it's a very nice low-tech denial-of-service attack. Paul, would you please fill us in?
Oh, yeah. So there are some very ingenious people in San Francisco who decided that they were going to sort of denial of service their entire area with a pair of wire cutters, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, a pair of pliers.
Can't beat low tech, right? I mean, they cut it physically. And this, of course, took out all of the fiber optic for Silicon Valley and parts of the San Francisco Bay Area. So this is like a VoIP, phone, your internet, your wireless. And it was out for more than 12 hours on Thursday. So that's actually quite an effective attack. Someone try that.
It sounds like there's someone out there going a little bit bananas with their tin snips, mate. But it's just amazing, isn't it, that a simple cut, a simple fiber cut like that from a, you know, manhole or a cabinet or something that is a pretty difficult environment to secure can cause such damage. I mean, everyone's worried about, you know, Russian criminals knocking Estonia offline with, you know, this massive botnet when really all they would have needed was a pair of pliers and, you know, one of those things for lifting up manhole covers.
Yeah. Oh, a pair of pliers will take anything offline. I mean, air gaps work wonders.
Yeah, that's old school air gap, you know, that's nice. And in this next story, something a little bit fun, something a little bit new. We love a new vector by which worms can spread. Twitter is cleaning up after a whole bunch of worm attacks on its site.
Yeah, it looks like there were multiple XSS vulnerabilities that was exploited on the weekend by a bored 17-year-old. He basically used cross-site scripting to make his own worm propagate. The worm didn't really do anything. There was nothing malicious attached to it. But it would infect the user's profile, and anyone who viewed the profile would then also be infected, and their friends would carry the worm along. The interesting thing is that it actually could have been much, much more critical. I mean, if he had actually used browser exploitation and tried to exploit the people that he's cross-site scripting to, this could have been a whole different story.
So that's the way you would have done it, huh?
Yeah, maybe. It was interesting that in his recent attack involved a message saying, "Hi, I'm Mikey," which is the guy's name, and included his phone number. The dude was gunning for a job at Twitter.
Yeah, well, apparently he was, like, directing people to some sort of other microblogging site called Stalk Daily, which he actually owns. So he was actually using the worm to promote his own business. But, you know, this is really reminiscent of the Sammy worm from MySpace. I don't know if you remember that one. But this guy just wrote a worm that just went around and, like, embedded, I think it was JavaScript-based or something like that, but it put it on everyone's profile so that anyone who'd view those profiles would add him as a friend. So he had something like 500,000 friends within 12 hours.
Yeah. Actually, it's a good way of making friends.
Yeah. Well, and it got them to post something on their walls, like, you know, on their feeds or whatever it is in MySpace land, saying, you know, Sammy is my hero or something like that.
Sammy's my hero,
Nice little vanity worm there. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like the new generation of worms or the next level of Ode. I mean, gone are sort of the days where we're seeing the overflow or the worm, but now it's a cross-site scripting in Twitter.
Yeah. It's awesome, isn't it? Just when you think it's about to get boring. Now, look, speaking of, trends, in this next story, Symantec released a bit of a report full of information on malware. It's basically its full year report for 2008. And holy smokes, man, you know, there was a lot of talk last year about just how much malware was out there, but they're talking about...
There's a lot.
Oh, no, man, you know, if you look at the graph, it is that typical exponential graph. We had something like in 2007 that they identified something like 600,000, you know, what they call threats. In 2008, that was up to 1.6 million. I mean, these are mind-boggling statistics, aren't they?
Yeah, it really is. And it was interesting to see that they also said that the number of vulnerabilities being released is also increasing. It was up 20% over last year, and over 80% of documented vulnerabilities were classified as easily exploitable.
Nice.
Wow, which is very worrying. I mean, that combined with malicious software and the rise of malicious software, you now have software that's exploiting you.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, we'll hear later, actually, I've got an interview in this week's show with Stuart Strathy, who is of Microsoft Australia, and he's talking about their latest report on malware, sort of the report that they crunched together with all of their telemetry, and they reckon the biggest threat that is currently facing consumers is from this rogue AV software that says, you know, you're infected, give us your credit card and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
He says they're getting so much traction with that. And
scareware, is it right?
Yeah, scareware. And I think one of the reasons that this stuff is actually working is a side effect of something good, which is the fact that people are actually aware of security being an issue that affects them. So they think they're doing the right thing by getting this software when, in fact, you know, they're buying bad stuff. So poor consumers.
That's cool. That ingenious, really.
It is when you think about it. It's like it's irony fraud or something. It's brilliant. But you'll also hear, actually, coming up in that interview later, there's a very interesting thing that he said, which is that they saw more infections. It's more common for a enterprise system at the moment to be infected with malware than it is for a consumer system, which I found absolutely stunning personally. So there you go. And speaking of all things Microsoft, they've just issued a big patch filling Excel, Windows, and Word holes. Now, what I find, we don't normally just cover bug stories and, you know, patches and stuff, but what I thought made this one worthy of a mention is that a lot of these holes were already being exploited in the wild. We're seeing a god-awful amount of Ode out there, aren't we?
Yeah, if you look at the security bulletin, it's full of really, looks like very, very critical vulnerabilities. I mean, bugs affecting XP, XP Professional, Server, IE 5, 6, 7, DirectX, there are a lot of bugs, and majority of these are allowing command execution. My personal take on this is that over the Christmas period and the New Year period, people actually have a whole lot more time on their hands. And I think that this big influx in vulnerability releases is actually coming from people spending their, you know, holiday time sitting down and finding O-Day.
Yeah, well, it's the direct opposite of what happens after Black Hat and DEF CON, because as soon as Black Hat and DEF CON's done, man, there's like absolutely no news of anything cool and new for about 2 months, like every year.
Yeah.
It's the journalist's worst nightmare. You got to have stuff backed up, ready to roll, you know, because like after Black Hat and DEF CON, yeah, no one's dropping anything interesting, you know, they all save it up for Vegas.
I think it's important to note with this that actually the, you know, the number of vulnerabilities year on year that Microsoft are releasing are actually decreasing. If you look at the MSRC, the number of vulnerabilities they had last year to the year before is about 20% less. I think although this is a pretty bad security bulletin, over the whole, we are actually seeing less vulnerabilities come out of Microsoft.
Well, and it's interesting because of where we're seeing them as well. So, you know, we used to see really bad OS vulnerabilities, and then they moved up into the browsers. And now the browsers are actually starting to come down a bit, and it's really all of those bugs are starting to be found in those secondary applications. So not stuff that directly interacts with the internet, but, you know, it's
like
all
Excel.
Exactly, like Excel, PowerPoint, Office, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So it is kind of interesting that the ground that we used to till for bugs, just people don't tend to bother with it as much anymore because there is much more fertile soil in Office. So it suggests to me that patch and fix is at least having, you know, some sort of measurable effect on the security of their products. So, but mate, that takes us to the end of the news. Paul, thank you very much for your time this week.
Hey, no worries, Ben.
Paul Craig on the line from Middle Earth there with a look at this week's news. Up next, it's time for this week's feature interview, and Verizon Business Security Solutions, which was actually a sponsor of this podcast years ago, has a pretty decent forensics practice, and these guys do all sorts of post-breach recovery stuff, you know, spooky forensic stuff and investigations. So they're exposed to a wide range of cleanups, and they produce some pretty interesting annual reports about what they see. Now, it's not completely comprehensive. You can't say that this report would tell you exactly what's going on everywhere, and I don't personally believe you can get a super accurate idea of the volume of breaches out there by looking at one company's caseload. But that said, the report is pretty compelling stuff. Brian Sarton is Verizon Business Security Solutions Director of Investigative Response and has been on Risky Business before. He joined me by phone to dissect the results of the company's latest report. Enjoy.
Well, this report from 2008 caseload, or 2009 data breach investigations report, spans really just 1 year of caseload versus the 4 year compilation study that that we released this past year. The previous report had about 4 years of casework, a little over 500 cases, and spanning about 230 million unique records compromised. This year, it's 1 year. It's about 100 cases. But interestingly, it's about 285 million records on such a smaller caseload population. And I think that number of records compromised in 1 year, that kind of speaks to the real evolution that that we see in this year's study. The major difference between this year's study versus what we've seen in the past is really in and around evolution. Evolution in complexity of the attacks, the types of entities being targeted, in particular, complexity of certain kinds of malcode, previously really thought to be only academically possible, and then, of course, this evolution in organized crime involvement. And we've got some great statistics on any one of these fronts.
Now, how many incidents are we actually talking about in that in incident terms, not record terms?
In actual incidents, we're talking about just under 100 individual incidents. And that's an interesting thing for us. Each year we handle cases with a couple of basic missions. And mission number one would be prove or disprove a suspected crime. Mission number two would be eliminate or incriminate a suspected individual or organization as being the source of a crime. And these are only situations where we're able to systematically prove, not disprove, where we're able to systematically incriminate, not eliminate, an organization as the likely source. So with that said, the once you take out the civil situations, you take out the scenarios where we can disprove or scenarios where we can eliminate an organization, then what you have left are really the approximately 100 cases.
One of the most interesting findings that I've seen just in the little notes that have been sent to me is that you guys believe that 9 out of 10 of these incidents were preventable by following what is described as the security basics. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
No question. Something we've seen all along, and it really comes to a fine point this year, is that basic security measures, simple, extremely cheap security measures, underscore the fact that, you know, it's sometimes the simplest things are your most effective deterrents. And we hit on that concept a number of times in the course of the study. When you look at, for example, the fact that as many as in the listing of unknown unknowns on inside the back of the report, actually, we talk about the extent of the situations which involve data stolen the companies didn't know they had. So 67% of the 285 million unique records compromised in this study, 67% of those were stolen from information stores the companies didn't know they had, and 38% of these 100 breaches involved data stolen they didn't know they had. So that's a little bit of a frightening statistic. Also, you have basic scenarios in and around their not only understanding of where data is located, but the extent to which they're actively monitoring for suspicious events and unwanted traffic. And it's interesting, for compliance purposes, you see organizations in different industries all across the globe who all claim that they're doing some form of actual event monitoring, but in reality, they're not. And that's why, and in quotes, actual event monitoring is one of our core recommendations. And we even went so far in this study as to bring that back to the PCI requirements. In particular, for the payment card industry data security standard, we charted how many organizations claimed compliance versus those that claimed to be not compliant going into the breach. And some, 19% of these claimed compliance. So we took that a little bit further to say, okay, how many of all of these cases, which sections of the PCI data security standard were actually in compliance at the time of the breach? Interestingly, only 11% of all of these entities were in fact compliant based upon our findings with Section 3, Protect Stored Data. And the underlying issue there, very simple thing is these companies didn't know what they consider to be sensitive data and where on their network it was located. We had to tell them. And then only 5% of all these entities were compliant with Section 10, all accesses to cardholder data.
That's always been the way, hasn't it? That people happily spend $200,000 to $1 million on, their IDS licenses, and then the logs just go into a black hole.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we see so many examples of this, like around patching. So many of these cases, a huge percentage of these involved hacking, much more than last year. And when you look at hacking, and naturally you have hacking that targets the operating system or services or individual applications, you have combinations of known and unknown vulnerabilities. So we saw a big percentage of these involving known vulnerabilities. So our response to that was, okay, if there were known vulnerabilities, then presumably there was some type of a hot fix or maintenance cluster or update, something like a patch made available by a vendor, to counteract that particular threat. So we looked into how long these patches or hot fixes had been made available. And by and large, almost all of these known vulnerabilities, there were fixes available 6 to 12 months, if not more than a year prior to the breach. And you always see organizations come back and say, well, maybe patching depth is not the issue. Maybe it's about frequency. And, okay, if it was an unpatched vulnerability, maybe we need to patch more quickly. Maybe every 6 months is not the answer. Maybe we need to patch every 3 months. If we're doing it every 3 months, then why don't we do it every 2 months? And what we've actually found, if all these vulnerabilities or the fixes are available for, more than 6 months, then by and large, patching it every 6 months is, that's spending enough as long as you're hitting all your desktops and servers. But the other side to that coin is that on almost every one of these cases, it seems, there's some core system in the network somewhere. Every desktop and server is hit, but there's a mainframe or a database application, some system set up by external consultants. No one wants to sneeze around it for fear you might take it offline. Everything gets patched but that one system, and it's ultimately that one system that gets hit. I'd say, adding to that, almost every one of these cases also demonstrates that concept that the fix is almost never spend more money. It's almost never buy more technologies or even get more smart people. It always seems to be, by and large anyway, the policies and process by which the people and technologies interact.
Well, we did a show recently which explored a survey that was released by an Oracle user group in conjunction with Oracle that found that most of their enterprise products were not patched within 6 months, actually out there in userland. So about 70% of these Oracle deployments had not had patches applied to them for 6 months or more. Now, that means they're two critical updates behind. This is, you know, this is a big deal, and it's for that exact reason that you said. No one wants to sneeze around it. It's too critical to be pulled down to patch. It's too critical for a dodgy patch to take that system offline, so people just don't bother. It's really quite sad, isn't it?
The what if, and actually also I think some of the information we have in the timeline aspects of this study speaks sort of volumes to that. It's, you know, it makes you wonder, something as simple as vulnerability scanning, internal vulnerability scanning, would identify, you know, these known vulnerabilities that aren't patched, you know, these releases that they haven't applied on that one system core to the network. And why aren't they running basic vulnerability scanning? If they are running it, why aren't they responding to some of the problems that are being highlighted in those scan results? And it's actually interesting with that said, you know, aside from the quantity of data, the percentage of these situations involving data stolen that companies didn't know they had, you have this sort of extension to that that says, well, at least the timeline part touches on average, these are never smash and grab situations. They don't happen in minutes. It's more like weeks or months or years. And we tracked the amount of time across all these cases from initial point of entry to the point at which the organization became aware that they had a problem, you know, all during which compromise is occurring to some extent or another. And you have devices being added to their networks. You have vulnerabilities on the databases, like you referenced, being exploited. You have unwanted activity, unwanted traffic, abuse of privileges, all of that. And so 7.5 months go by. They don't see all of this stuff. And the question becomes, how do they become aware they have a problem? And more, just about 3 out of 4 of these actually did not involve the organization finding evidence of security breach themselves, not through log monitoring or through event monitoring or even through the course of an audit. Almost 3 out of 4 of these cases were situations where someone else told this company they had a problem, some sort of third-party notification.
Yeah, I was actually about to bring that up, which is it's one of the key findings here, is that in 69% of the cases, the breach was actually discovered and disclosed by a third party. I mean, so can you give us an example of how that might actually work? What sort of third party is actually going to be in a position to spot that data has leaked?
Most of the third-party notification we see still today is driven by fraud patterns. The most common example would be a retailer. Now, imagine you're the manager of a retail store, and you've been the manager for 6 months, and only once in that six-month stretch has a customer come in and said, I've got fraud on a credit card or on my checking account, and I've only used this account once. It's been at your store to buy shoes, for example. And, you know, now the account's been reissued and my bank says the problem happened here. What do I need to know? You know, you hear one of those in 6 months. Well, that might not concern you too much, just an anomaly. But you get 38 comments like that from different customers on a Wednesday morning as a store manager. That means something different.
Yeah.
And that's the most common example. Someone recognizes fraud and it ties back, and it might be law enforcement acting on fraud patterns that they're picking up in the form of formal complaints. You might have a bank who picks up a fraud pattern or a pattern within fraud spend, for example, that ties back to legitimate account usage at a given organization. And that, you know, the more of that you have, the more pattern like that constitutes oftentimes very compelling circumstantial evidence of a problem there. And that's usually how we get engaged. It's some type of external notification, and that external pressure to conduct an investigation becomes so severe that finally the organization gives in. And that's, you know, that ultimately they retain an entity like us. But one thing I do want to note here in the time we have is the extent to which law enforcement these days in different countries across the globe is becoming far more effective at monitoring the underbelly of the internet, in particular dynamic and static content online. So, for example, in Australia and in other countries, we are actively coordinating with law enforcement and are finding out reports. A lot of our investigations start with reports where in an IRC channel or chat room where certain types of data in mass quantities are typically bought, sold, and traded, law enforcement works through informants and through their own resources to identify situations where individuals are, say, claiming they have access to an entity or offering data they claim to be stolen from a given entity, you know, for sale. And based upon the information they're able to recover online, they'll go to an organization and see, hey, there's no question about it. This person was selling access to your environment and selling this type of data. We purchased it, and yes, this information, no question, came from your organization, the confines of your environment. You need to investigate.
Mm-mm. Now, look, I mean, that leads me to my next question, which is, what exactly is it that the bad guys are after? Is it solely credit card data? Because I imagine that that would be the most valuable kind of data out there for up for grabs.
It's not solely credit card data. We see combinations of different types of data, and we always have financial data, identity-related information. But it just so happens that, I mean, cyber criminals tend to be after quantities of data and types of data that are worth greater dollar values. And unfortunately, a lot of times, I mean, that centers around the types of data that set the stage for fraud. I mean, what's better if you can steal, just general account information or name and address information or social insurance information from about an individual? That's one thing. But if you can steal information necessary, say, to counterfeit a credit card, well, perhaps the fraudster could use that to buy a big screen TV or stay in a fancy hotel room for a bunch of nights, or perhaps first class airline tickets or something like that. And by the time somebody finds out, well, that's maybe 60 days later.
Mm.
And that's the real evolution. That magstripe fraud is, I'd say, the number one common bucket that we've always seen, and that represented about 83% of our cases last year, or at least in that the compilation study. But this year, it's been a little bit of an evolution. Truthfully, as you may have seen, I'm sure, growing into last year, we had worked about three of the world's five largest known compromises on record. And this past year, well, the first three, the one, two, and three largest compromises on record, well, there's three new ones. And we have been fortunate enough to be involved in those situations as investigators. And what they're showing us is that, again, that concept of cybercrime chasing the almighty dollar, well, it's happening again. And because of these massive breaches occurring, the quantities of that type of data on the information black market have made prices plummet. Whereas what it takes to counterfeit, for example, a credit or debit card, we saw those prices in and around, say, 14 U.S. dollars or 16 U.S. dollars per record. And we've seen those prices drop to as low as 15 or 20 cents a record. And because of that, fraudsters aren't just after that data, but they're after the consumer PIN as well. And the PIN obviously not only sets the stage for fraud, but also for the theft of actual assets from the consumer. And that hits the general public, people like you and me, a lot harder than we've ever seen before.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? I kind of get the impression that the banks have shot themselves in the foot by not actually issuing, well, not really, because the merchants are the ones who are liable, but they really should have considered rolling out two-factor authentication with credit cards like they did with their own accounts. But again, because they're not paying for this fraud themselves and the liability rests on the merchant, I get the impression, they don't really care as much as perhaps they should.
Mm. Well, it is that's an interesting topic that you bring up. And in fact, I've been, for example, to industry related fraud conferences before and seen presentations on, great example would be chip and PIN or RFID technologies. And in particular with chip and PIN, something that's been out there as a technology for such a long time, you see a map of the globe. And they'll have, a listing in the presentation of countries that, countries that have a pilot program for chip and PIN in place, and B, companies that are out of the testing stage and planning a mass rollout, and then countries that have rolled out already chip and PIN technologies in mass. And it's interesting, as you looked at that map of the world, the countries that had already rolled out chip and PIN seem to be the very few countries where we don't see payment card related breaches. At least if we do, it's in very small numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote an opinion piece recently for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, in which I argued that malware would be less of a problem if credit card data was actually rendered completely worthless, which chip and PIN more or less does. So we really need to, as a society, we need to start pressuring the banks to improve their authentication techniques on credit card transactions so that all of this money doesn't wind up in the hands of all of these unsavory people.
That's a very good point. And as you bring that up, I've mentioned a moment ago some of the complexity we've seen on the malcode front. You know, it's not just specialized tools that are undetectable by antivirus that are designed to capture data in transit, you know, bound to logical and physical interfaces on a server, whereas the data at rest on that server is already encrypted. You know, they're exploiting a perceived weakness in a standard. And you know, it's not just those kind of tools. Well, it's expanded from there to be these RAM scrapers, I'm sure you've heard of, where they're targeting, specifically targeting sequences of data within random access memory on a server. Even servers that are encrypting data in transit and data at rest, well, you know, even a big database server, a transaction comes in, it needs to unencrypt that transaction, parse it, decide what to do with it, send it along, write it to a log locally. And once it's written locally, well, it's encrypted again, but that tenth of a second when it parses it, that data is vulnerable. And that's even expanded from there to unallocated space scrapers where the perpetrators, the authors of the code, are using forensics tool capabilities against the good guys, you know, recovering data that's long since deleted and not accessible by the end user administrator of the system. You know, those are particularly concerning, but you have a very valid point. Even with these more insidious tools that we're seeing today, depending upon the technology used within the payment chain, that data would not necessarily be as vulnerable even to those types of threats.
Yeah, yeah. Now, look, as a way to wrap this up, Brian, I just figured I'd ask you as my last question, where you see this stuff going in the next couple of years. Do you think that things are getting worse or do you think that things are getting better? And what's your rationale for those opinions either way?
That's a really good question, and I'm glad you asked it. Well, you see both things getting better and things getting worse. There's all that old adage about the good guys get better and the bad guys get worse, and they always seem to find some way to stay a step or two ahead. And sure enough, what we see here, and there's data in our report that makes us very clear, we're definitely seeing cybercrime attack vectors and strategies evolving considerably. It's interesting. Things like packet snippers that grab data out of RAM and out of unallocated space, what they're targeting are weaknesses, perceived weaknesses in standards. For example, there's so many standards out there nowadays that require encryption of data in transit, but not encryption of data, encryption of data at rest, whereas not encryption of data in transit. You know, they're going after a weak spot, a perceived issue in the standard by targeting that data in transit. Well, we've certainly seen a lot of those tools and those types of things evolve. And the reason why it's interesting to note that we're seeing those evolving is because they're specifically targeting companies that are compliant, because more and more entities that handle volumes of data of value on the information black market and to cyber criminals, well, you know, those companies, you know, they've been saddled with compliance mandates of different kinds for years, and they are making progress in that direction. But the converse there is that the cyber criminals are getting better with the malcode, and in particular, you know, SQL injection, you'll see under the hacking category in the study, is the number two hacking type that we see and accounts for the massive volume. I believe 79% of all the records, 285 million. You know, that's a big number. But surprisingly, despite that big number, we are actually seeing that SQL injection is on the decline. And that's a product of the evolution of cybercrime. And it used to be with botnet attacks and SQL injection attacks, you might imagine, no one ever hacks into a company and steals data from their home DSL line, you know, or their home cable modem line or something. They hide behind a hijacked system or a proxy. We call them staging points, and that staging point is an abstraction layer that shields the perpetrator from identification and arrest. And now that evolution is one where that abstraction layer is no longer a hijacked system, because companies like us, it takes us minutes sometimes to see the real source, you know, bringing in to metrics and data types we can derive from our network backbone, and use in the course of an investigation. So now, instead of systems being abstraction layer, it's people. And that's why you see vendors, you know, being such a huge percentage, one-third, vendor and partner-related breaches of what we're seeing. That's the direction that cyber criminals are going. They find humans to use as staging points. And instead of attacking a retailer, for example, or banks directly, they are doing a great job these days, unfortunately, of finding individuals who offer services to those banks and, you know, to those retailers. And they say, you know, they go to the call centers and the help desks and the support centers for the vendors these companies use, who have access to not just one retailer, for example, or bank, but many. And they say, find vulnerable individuals. They say, hey, you hate your boss, you're in financial dire straits, we're your solution. Give us access to the data. You know, better yet, give us access to your customers and we'll make use of it and make it worth your while. That is really, that's what's driving a lot of those third-party partner cases we're seeing.
War continuing, no one winning.
War continuing, evolution continuing, and we should have some pretty surprising results next year.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to speaking to you about it then. Brian Sutton, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you as well, Patrick.
Brian Sutton on the line from the US of A there, and you can go to risky.biz and read a post in the news and opinion section that links back to that report. 52 pages of goodness. Some very good weekend reading if you're into that sort of thing. While you're at the site, go and have a read of Metal Storm's latest column, How Poor Scoping Can Be Disastrous to Security. If you're a CSO or someone responsible for slicing security resources into separate silos, you absolutely have to read the piece. It makes some very good points, some very astute observations, and in Metal's usual style, it's pretty damn funny as well, so a good read. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Microsoft Australia's security strategist, Stuart Strathdy. Now, these interviews are basically paid slots that fund the rest of the content that goes into the show. But that's okay, because they're usually pretty interesting in their own right. And particularly in this case, that is the case. It's a very interesting interview, this one. Stuart joined us by phone to discuss the company's latest security intelligence report. Now, Microsoft has access to all sorts of telemetry through Windows these days, and a lot of analysts, a lot of sort of security brain power over there these days. So the reports they belt out are actually interesting. So I started off by asking Stuart if the dreaded Conficker worm had screwed up the most recent report by skewing the data the company collected.
So the Conficker virus definitely does feature in the report. But obviously, there's been a number of other key findings that I think have surprised many in the industry, but also been particularly revealing for some of the trends over the past 6 months.
So what are those findings?
Well, number one was that rogue security software has increased in its prevalence so enormously in the past 6 months. And it really was something that we had seen it start to build a little bit, but I think it was quite unexpected that it would be this prevalent so soon.
So this is the stuff that says, hey, you've been infected by everything under the sun, give us your credit card number and we'll fix it up, okay?
Absolutely. you know, it's all the pop-ups that you so often see claiming that they'll fix it as long as you provide your credit card details.
It's funny, you know, because I actually think that one of the reasons for the success of these rogue antivirus products is actually that, you know, in part it's because there's actually an increased awareness around security and people are trying to do the right thing and they're getting burned anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, people do have an increased awareness and they are trying to do the right thing. So the importance of sticking with a product or a vendor that you can trust is, you know, self-evident these days. But yeah, we certainly encourage people to, you know, be vigilant, try to maintain your system and be aware of security issues whenever you're online.
And what is it that you guys can do about that specific or that particular problem? Is this something that you can address with like the malware removal tools and things like that, or do they sort of move in and disable them?
The malicious software removal tool is obviously one of the frontline weapons in this fight. But then also Windows Defender is another product that we keep the definitions updated to try to identify this stuff and remove it. It is one of those situations, however, that, you know, it's a constant battle. So people do need to be vigilant in, you know, keeping the products up to date.
And I suppose, too, that once the software is on somebody's system, they've already used their credit card to pay for it anyway. So, like, removing it after the fact isn't exactly going to do a lot, is it?
Yes, so that situation is one where they'll need to involve their bank as much as involve their, you know, security software vendor.
Now, what's shaken in the enterprise? Because, I mean, that's sort of an issue that more often than not affects consumers. It's not really an enterprise issue. What are some of the trends or findings in the most recent report that directly impact the enterprise?
So one of the most interesting findings that came out of the report is that enterprises are actually more likely to be infected than the average home user.
That's a real surprise.
Absolutely. Now, some of the things that we've seen is that the type of malware that attacks an enterprise versus the type of malware that attacks an individual is very different. And so that will go some way to explaining what was quite an unexpected result. The stuff that we see in enterprises is typically more your worm that moves across network shares and that sort of thing, whereas the stuff that we're seeing for consumers is more the keystroke loggers, the password stealers, and the game sort of keystroke capture technology. So it's more malware rather than worm or virus.
Yes, I mean, I imagine the stuff that would have got... I understand Conficker was actually a big hit on intranets because... on LANs. Because because of the network file share auto run problem.
Yeah, so obviously Conficker, it could spread across network shares, it can spread across USB drives, it had multiple ways of distributing itself across your network. And, you know, targeting weak passwords and that sort of thing, we were quite surprised at just how many customers did have such weak password policies. And so, you know, the key thing with Conficker was to make sure that you were installing the updates from Microsoft Update and also, you know, that you harden up your password policies and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it must be somewhat disheartening to see such, you know, trivial and easy techniques being exploited by malware writers and worm writers and stuff and seeing them, you know, get into the enterprise. I mean, that must drive you guys nuts.
Well, I think there's always, in any environment, when you do a security review, there's always room for improvement. There's not many customers that we review where we couldn't tweak something or do something a little better here or there. So the Conficker worm has really just reminded everyone that they do need to review their security policies and potentially just bring them up to date to the latest threats.
What sort of organisations were being smashed by malware? Because you say it's actually more prevalent than in the home, which is contrary to the popular wisdom. It seems to be a lot easier to lock down Windows in the enterprise than it is for the average consumer, because at least there's some skill in the enterprise when it comes to securing this stuff. So what sort of size of enterprise was being affected by this stuff, or was it pretty much across the board?
It was. Well, I'll just start with making one minor point. Conficker, when I was talking about the fact that enterprises were hit more than your average home user, I wasn't being specific to Conficker. So that's a general statement about all malware and all worms and viruses. In terms of Conficker, what we often found is that a lot of the lead time and the testing time that corporations required to roll out the updates from Microsoft Update, that was often what hurt the enterprise customers. In terms of the size of the corporation that was hit, we saw everything. We saw, customers from the very small customers, the small business and sort of home offices, right up to your major corporates. But obviously, I'm not mentioning any names.
No, I wouldn't expect you to, Stuart. It's okay. We will not demand answers. But look, the other thing is you are saying that it's not just Conficker. That wasn't something that skewed the statistics. Is that right?
So Conficker certainly was prevalent in the statistics, but I wouldn't say that it heavily skewed them one way or the other, no.
Okay. Now, have there been any other findings that that jump out and you think are worthy of a mention?
I think the overall finding is, once again, we've seen that attacks on applications are increasing and increasing, while the attacks on the browser and the attacks on the OS are actually diminishing. The other key finding that's obviously a good one for Microsoft is that we're finding that Vista is standing up very, very well in terms of overall vulnerabilities and attacks against that platform. So I think everyone's been quite aware in the security industry for probably the past 2 years that application-level attacks are on the increase, and now we really do have the second lot of data to prove that that's what's actually taking place.
Speaking of which, I mean, XP's got to be, what, about 7 years old or something like that now?
Yeah, I believe it was yesterday that XP moved into extended support.
Which is, how many years is that?
I think you're right. I think it was six or seven years now.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds... I mean, it could even be a bit longer. God, time flies. But so, you know, really, Windows 7 is shipping with a lot of the protections that that Vista has, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it also has a few more.
Yeah.
So obviously, being a new version of the OS, we've slipped a few extra features in. I think probably the big one that most of our customers are talking about in terms of security additions at the moment is BitLocker to Go, which is basically encryption for removable storage devices.
So no more dramas for all the idiots leaving customer records in taxis.
Hopefully not. That's if they're using it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just before we go, one thing, you know, you mentioned application bugs. Any update yet on when we can expect a patch for that PowerPoint bug? Is that out already? Or
So it's one that is still currently under investigation.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not able to release timelines as to exactly when we'll, you know, patch or update these issues, because that basically just sets a timeline for all of the malware creators out there as well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, here's our Windows. Sweet.
So I can certainly assure everyone that, you know, it is being treated seriously. It has got top priority within Microsoft. And we'll do the right thing by customers. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, so you guys actually found that this was being exploited. You caught it somehow, didn't you? Or was it a customer report or something like that?
So we've actually got a range of telemetry systems. Sometimes we'll catch it through crashes. So you probably know the crash reporting system that pops up a window and says, can we send this back to Microsoft?
Yeah.
Sometimes we catch vulnerabilities through those systems. Other times it may be reported to us via a security researcher or come in through the Microsoft Security Research Center. This one, I believe, was actually reported to us. The exact circumstances of which, I don't have those details, but, as I said, there's a whole range of telemetry that we rely on for this stuff.
Okay, Stuart Strathdy, thank you very much for taking some time out to update us on the latest report. Well, just out of curiosity, mate, where can listeners who want to read the full report get it?
Microsoft.com/SIR. That will take them to the malware portal that they can download either the full copy or the key findings.
Okay, Stuart Strathdy, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Patrick.
Step away, you haven't seen an accident. No incident. There's nothing to see here. Step away, it'll only cause a precedent. It's irrelevant. There's no one but me here. Step away, you'll only get an oxygen. And in the state I'm in.
Stuart Strathdy from Microsoft there in this week's sponsor interview. Now, at the suggestion of one Risky Business listener, we're changing the audio mailbag segment. Instead of asking you all out there just to ring in with a comment, there's now a weekly question, and I figured I'd start with a simple one. So to all of the people out there responsible for their organization's security, what's keeping you up at night? What do you find the biggest challenge to be in your job? Is it trying to alter organizational culture? Is it finding the right tools? Is it dealing with vendors? Is it getting your web applications locked down or convincing the Oracle team that they should maybe run the critical patches? Basically, what I'm asking all of you guys out there, guys and girls out there, to tell me is what the biggest pain in your ass as a security pro is. So you can call Sydney 02-8569 1835 or USA on 877-688-8417. That's toll free. So please give us a bell and tell us what you hate in your job. And that's it for this week's show. Taking us out is a track from the latest record by Peregrine, a great band. The album is called Stay Inside and Misbehave, and the track is Everything's Under Control. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.